This is the conference coordinator. I'd like to inform all participants that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Okay. Would someone like to take the roll?
Absolutely, Jeff. I'll do that. It's Gisela. Good morning, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Jeff Newman, James Bladel, Tatiana Kramsova, Gabriel Pinheiro, Alan Greenberg. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Glenn de Saint-Géry, Margie Milam, myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and apologies, Avery Doria and Paul Diaz. And if I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Everyone, welcome. It is Thursday, September 24th. It's the PDP work team call. And the agenda for today is, and hopefully a shorter call, because I actually have to apologize. I'm only able to stay on for about an hour. But if anyone wants to take over afterwards, they're certainly welcome. We are going to quickly address the status of the surveys that have been filled out regarding Stage 2, go over what's going on with Stage 1 with the paper, and then go immediately into Stage 3. Does anybody have any questions on that?
Regarding the survey, for those of us who are negligent, is it still an option to fill it in?
That was Alan.
Yes, it was Alan. Sorry.
No, that's great. You actually just touched on it. The survey, it's still open.
Okay.
If Marika, correct me if I'm wrong, we've had 6 people respond so far. It is open at, until Monday, this Monday, so hopefully people can do it. If they can't do it during the week, they can do it over the weekend. And, we're hoping to get more responses on that. And the again, just as a reminder of how we use the survey, it's not. It's really just a tool to help us when we're drafting some of the recommendations in the recommendations document for Stage 2. It's pretty similar as to how we use the one in for Stage 1. And the goal is to next week on the next call to go over the survey results and to finally tune it so that by Seoul we could have a good concrete draft of Stage 2 of the recommendations document. I see James has his hand up. James?
Thanks, Jeff. This is James. I just wanted to ask for a reminder purposes. How many stages in total are we expecting for this process?
49.
Yeah, or do we know? That's fair.
But
we don't know
America.
Yet.
This is Merck. In principle, we had outlined 5 stages of the PDP, but there is well some what we called overarching stages, such as like the overall timing and role of translation and things like that. But I don't know if we're necessarily going to do a survey on those or whether that's going to be more part of the overall discussion when we have, you know, all the stages outlined. But the basic stages, I think, that we have now are 5.
Okay, thank you. And I would welcome any opportunity to fold those together as well.
So I think just as a reminder, what's going to happen is we're going to have papers on each of the stages, and then the goal is to then join them into one document and realizing that we're going to have to touch those overarching issues as well as go back and forth because, you know, as we learned on the last call and several calls, you get to something in Stage 2 that you go, wait a minute, I think we discussed that in Stage 1. It's very similar. What do we decide there? And we should make it consistent. And I think we've been trying to do that as we go along, but, you know, it's obviously going to take someone looking at it from beginning to end to really judge that consistency. And on Stage 1, we do have the paper out, but we haven't gotten any comments out. The paper has been out for several weeks now. I venture to say probably a month or more, and we have not gotten any comments on it. So please, I'll again ask for some more comments on Stage 1, the document, so we can at least put it aside completely until we get done with the next 4 stages. Okay, so with that said, I see some Other people have joined the call, and Gisela has put that down. I also see Robin has joined on Adobe, Robin Gross. So let's go into stage three, which is called the work phase. Stage three is we checked with the policy process. The working group work team of the PPSC, who is addressing how working groups are supposed to operate, how really the development of the charter is supposed to work, things like that. This kind of is, we're not really going to touch on the inner workings of the working group, but kind of everything really around that and more procedural items as opposed to dealing with the substance of the working group. So if you look at the Stage 3 document that's on Adobe right now, which everyone should have the ability to scroll through, yes?
David Maher joining.
Hey, David. So you can see that the things that this touches on really are dealing with things like face-to-face meetings, communication with general counsel or other outside groups, dealing with public comment periods, and feasibility, implementation, impact studies, things like that, that could give some guidance in the working group process. So with that said, if you look at the document, the first question is how to maximize the effectiveness of working groups, and the two concerns or questions that were raised early on that fit into this category is what should be the role of face-to-face meetings with working groups, if any, and should there be a mechanism to report a process failure? And if yes, how should that work? So why don't we start with, let's start with the second one first, because I think some people on this, James, I know you were one of them. Actually, Marika's got her hand up. Marika?
No, I just wanted to point out that what the working group work team has developed or will be looking at is like a procedure for resolution of problems. I mean, this might fall in there as well, but I guess this question, the approach this group might take more is like, what if the working group doesn't produce... I think the idea behind this question is more thinking about, so what if the group doesn't produce a document that they're, is in their charter, or what if they don't respect any of the timelines, or those kind of process failures, because all the other issues, like what if the group cannot reach consensus, or someone doesn't disagree with a certain decision, that's something that the work team is looking at, a process for addressing those kind of problems.
So. Okay, and is this also maybe to look at, and I see Alan's hands up, to look at a way for, if the working group itself doesn't institute it, maybe a way for the council to address a failure that it perceives? Because I don't, what I hear from you is talking about something stemming from within the work group.
Yeah.
As opposed
to it's more, that's really the escalation from within a working group where someone can first raise it with the chair, or then you go to the liaison, then you go to the chartering organization, or like in this case, in the policy development process, the council. So indeed, this might be as well the other way around where the council sees that things are really going the wrong way, and that might partly maybe because the council liaison indicates that, or there's some other ways in which that comes through. So that's not something that the working team is looking at, as far as I'm aware.
Okay. Alan, you got your hand raised?
Yeah, partly in comment in one of the things that you said and partly in general. You asked, is this a failure that the council recognizes? Well, unless the liaison brings the issue to the council isn't going to recognize a failure until it gets awful severe and something is brought to them. So I really think these are internally recognized failures. Whether it's recognized by everyone or recognized by, the chair is more an issue. And the kinds of things that I was thinking of are not the absolute deadlock or failure, but just the spinning wheels and not making progress or continuing to revisit the same issues over and over again. And I'm wondering how one addresses that other than saying get a better chair, which sometimes is the proper answer, I suspect. Are we looking at that kind of process failure, or are we looking only at the massive self-destruct ones?
I mean, my voice is cracking here. The overall category, the overall issue is how to maximize effectiveness, right? So I think it's addressing all of that. It could address everything from the chair or capture of a group. There's a whole bunch of things that I think could go into the effectiveness. Or is it really, I mean, your first part about it is, should it really be up to the working group? And unless the working group and liaison report these issues, there's nothing really for the council to do.
No, I don't think there isn't, unless other than triggered by an inordinately long amount of time. But presumably the liaison will start triggering questions before then. Capture is an interesting one I hadn't thought of, but yes, that's quite relevant, given that our work group composition is pretty open-ended.
Right. So, James, you were part of the Fast Flux team, and you've expressed before some comments on effectiveness of that group, at least initially. Do you have any comments on this or any thoughts, given your experiences with that group?
Yeah, I mean, I probably have expressed those in the past, Jeff. I'm on the spot here, just, you know, just shooting from the hip a little bit. I think that Alan touched on them as well. It's just, you know, a failure of a group doesn't necessarily mean it's actually come to some sort of a outcome and then that is the wrong outcome. It's more likely that it will just kind of spin off indefinitely and continue to go over the same topics, you know, ad infinitum. I think that one of the challenges, just personally, that I'm seeing is that a lot of decision-making capabilities are being expected from working groups, but working groups in and of themselves don't really have any decision mechanism except for consensus or lack of consensus. So I think that, you know, that could be one thing to look at. As far as identifying that a mechanism that the working group process has failed and then executing some sort of a mechanism to report that or to restart that, I think that, you know, we had some relative success with FastFlux in a couple of what we called rebooting the process and taking what we'd done before and trying to organize that and get it back on the rails, but I'm not sure exactly whether that should be coming internally or to the working group or externally from council.
So you said that trying to go back here. How in that group was the rebooting process? How was that initialized? Did it take basically the chair resigning, and how did that come about?
Yeah, I think that's correct. You know, that we had an interim chair. Aubrey stepped in to kind of cover until we could reestablish that group. We you know, put out a renewed call for to reengage the volunteers who we had lost throughout the process, and got a good delegation of the original volunteers back into the process, and then, you know, worked, you know, wanted to be respectful to the work that we had done, but we weren't chained to it either. We wanted to make sure we kept what we felt was still relevant and went forward with finishing up what items remained. So there was a kind of a process of, you know, reestablishing the charter, reestablishing the base of volunteers, and then just kind of, you know, as if you were kicking off a new working group and all the administrative things you have to do to get that thing going.
Okay.
I think Marika or staff might have a little better perspective on that, because I think that they did all the work, so they might have a better idea of what that entailed.
And Marika has her hand raised, so maybe that's what she wants to talk about, Marika?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to raise that this was maybe one of those occasions where, you know, although, you know, the group was struggling, but it was more on the content basis and, you know, people had difficulties on the definition and, you know, it was a slow process. But I think this was one of the areas where it was one of those actions where the chair actually suddenly resigned. I don't think many of us expected it, where the group suddenly was like, hey, so what do we do now? So that might be one of those instances where you might want to have a mechanism. And, I mean, something that the working team, for example, is looking at is, you know, should there be a system of having vice chairs or co-chairs? So of course, if you create some kind of backup in that scenario, you might already have someone that can step in the case of someone suddenly dropping out, either because, you know, they can't cope with the work anymore or for personal reasons or to ensure continuity or, you know, of a working group. Because it was quite a, you know, it caused quite some difficulty indeed finding an interim chair, trying to get people interested again and making sure that they felt that this group was going to go somewhere and not just, you know, be left, you know, hanging somewhere. So, again, I mean, this group might need to see, is this something that they want to consider from the perspective of in a policy development process? As said, in the working group work team, they are looking at some areas that might address some of those questions. So there might be some overlap, but I think, you know, it doesn't prevent this group from coming up with ideas if there are any to address situations like those.
How far along is the other work team on this issue? Has it even come up, or is it something still to get there?
The other the work team has already almost finalized the charter drafting guidelines, and the next thing staff will be posting a first draft of working group guidelines in which dispute resolution process has been described and also like roles of vice chairs and co-chairs. So they will have some draft text to review. Most of that language is basically what is currently being used. So that's something for that group to review, whether they want to keep the language that's in there, although we have identified that there are some gaps, because it, for example, only talks now about, you know, if someone complains to the liaison, and the liaison agrees, the liaison goes to the chair goes into the chartering organization, but it doesn't describe other scenarios, like what if the liaison and the chair disagree, what happens then? So, and it doesn't discuss either, like, you know, what should happen if the chair suddenly resigns or what kind of process should be in place. It might be something if this group feels strongly that that's a scenario that should be incorporated, you might want to throw that over to the work team when they actually start discussing that specific procedure in more detail, that they can take that into consideration and foresee that. So that's another way of addressing it possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it sounds like is that most of this is really dealing with issues that they should be thinking about. And since they are addressing it, since you're writing a paper on it, you can kind of add some of the questions that we've talked about here. I think it'd probably be better if we just maybe moved on and looked at what they came out with, and if we thought that there should be additional things from another level or from another angle from the policy process, then maybe we can add it at that point. I just don't want to rehash the same things that they're going to be talking about. That makes sense?
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
So the other question in this area is face-to-face meetings and how that would work. I guess right now there are face-to-face meetings of working groups at, you know, usually in conjunction with ICANN meetings. I would assume that that's probably something. Well, let me ask, throw it out to the group. Do people believe that there should be time set aside for working groups to meet at the ICANN meetings? Is that? I'm assuming. Yeah, there's people with their hands. Alan and then James.
My simple answer to that is yes, there should be. In practice, it ends up where everyone gets together from around the world, but you never end up talking about these issues because the schedule just doesn't allow it, and it's the meeting is too full. And if you meet on a given topic, it's probably about a workshop talking to the rest of the public instead of the work group people talking at each other, unless it's one of such great substance that the whole council is interested, or half the council, and then maybe some time gets allocated for it. So in practice, my experience says, yes, we should be meeting face-to-face. In practice, we don't. Maybe that's not everyone's experience, but that seems to be the what happens on the groups that I've been working on.
Okay. I have James next.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in. Similar to what Alan was saying, but with some key differences, and one is that I would like to see that, you know, it's an option for working groups, but if we start requiring all active working groups to meet during ICANN meetings or to use ICANN meetings to conduct a face-to-face equivalent of their weekly or biweekly teleconferences, I think that that's going to put pressure on an already overburdened schedule. Secondly, I would say that Alan is correct, is that you have to make a distinction between who the intended audience or what the purpose of that session would be. I think it was in either Sydney or Mexico City where we had kind of a half and half. The first part was a public workshop for registration abuse, and then after that it was a closed meeting just for the folks who have been active on the working group up to that point. So, you know, I think that it can work, and it can actually serve as a recruiting tool for additional volunteers.
Do you think the way that worked was good, the way you had that public session and then followed by, the workshop followed by the working groups and meeting?
Yeah, I think that was relatively successful, and we were able to, you know, make that distinction. I think it was the first hour or something was a session of that group, and then we opened it up to the public workshop afterwards.
And I think your point on a good recruiting tool is actually pretty important. Even if it's not a hugely substantive meeting, if you can use that to recruit additional people to the group, I think that's a good thing. So, Marika.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to share, you know, some current experiences and current practices, and then first commenting on the recruiting tool, and especially for registration abuse, it was actually extremely successful, and we really got some new people involved there that, you know, hadn't been engaged or involved in any policy development process before, and at least on the different working groups that I've been running to date, I've always tried at the start of the issue to get some kind of workshop or meeting at an ICANN meeting, because I think it really helps trying to inform people on an issue and get them then interested to sign up to a working group. So from, I think, a recruitment perspective, it's very important, and I think it's something we've raised as well in the earlier stages that's important to already socialize the subjects and get input early on, and that hopefully will mean as well that people are interested and engaged to join. How it currently works for most of the working groups, when an ICANN meeting comes up, we normally ask them, first of all, would you like to have a meeting? Do you think there's value? And it often depends as well, like who's going to be present, so how many members of the working group can participate, or whether there's a specific issue they would like to put forward for community discussion and benefit from the broader community being present there. So at this stage, it's really up to the working group to decide. And from my experience, most working groups do opt for meeting face-to-face at an ICANN meeting, because I think many see the benefit of sitting down and having that opportunity, even if it's just an hour, to get together. And many other members just then dial in remotely so they can still participate, even though they're not physically there.
So, I mean, it could be a recommendation from the group. Because I from my experience, I kind of agree with Alan that trying to just continue, or maybe, I'm sorry, maybe it was actually James, trying to just continue a normal weekly meeting is a little bit more difficult at these face-to-face meetings. But trying to come up with a subject to discuss and get community input is actually pretty valuable. And so it could be a recommendation from this group, if we wanted, to say there should be a meeting of the working group, but that meeting can be structured in several different ways. It could be a face-to-face ordinary meeting, if that's what the group decides, or it could be more geared towards a workshop to solicit input that otherwise they wouldn't obtain in their normal weekly calls. So I see James and Alan.
Yeah, Jeff, and this is James. I would be happy with a recommendation like that. And I think that just, you know, at this point, personally, I would like to see some sort of qualifiers attached to that recommendation that there'd have to be a compelling reason to meet during the general or the ICANN meeting. You know, for example, that there were things that they were looking for input from the community that they couldn't get on a teleconference, and or they were having some sort of time-sensitive issue that couldn't, you know, couldn't be postponed a couple of weeks to leave a hole for the general meeting. So I just would hate to see it become a standard operating procedure for all working groups that they, you know, require workshops and face-to-face meetings at all the ICANN meetings. If it's an option and if there's something that they're going to be able to achieve out of that that they couldn't otherwise on a teleconference, that's great, but just wouldn't want to see it as one of the necessary steps.
Well, let me ask a question, and then I'll go to Alan. I believe the IETF actually does require working groups to hold meetings during their session. I know you're a member of a lot of working groups, so for you individually it might be hardship, or for some other of us that are in a bunch of them. But other than that, I mean, what's the – and maybe I'll ask this of Alan, and then you can come back and answer. You know, why – I'm not sure I fully understand why it couldn't be that the working group should have a meeting at each, why you'd have to demonstrate a compelling need or there's a time-sensitive issue. So let me go to Alan, and then I'll come back to you, James, if you want to answer that.
I guess I was going to say something almost completely opposite. I think the public meeting, the workshop or whatever, is a very valuable tool if you know you need specific input at a time and you want to get a good conversation going with the people, or if you're trying to recruit. So for both of those, I think there is a valid, or if you simply feel you've been doing this long enough that you need to give feedback to the public. The issue of a face-to-face meeting of the work group itself, I think, is a little bit more complex. And given how far out you have to schedule these meetings, it's not always clear that, you know, if I look at work groups that I'm in, are we going to have a particularly compelling time-sensitive issue where we don't have consensus and have to stare at each other's eyes to get it when we arrive in Seoul? I don't know where the workgroup's going to be that week. So it's hard to tell whether we will be in a situation where we desperately need a face-to-face and it's opportune that we're meeting in Seoul, or it's almost a no-brainer that, you know, we could do it here, but we could do it on a teleconference just as well. I'm someone who believes very strongly that the dynamics in a face-to-face meeting are different. And you can hammer out consensus in a face-to-face meeting sometimes when you just cannot do it over a teleconference. So I'm a strong believer in face-to-face. I don't think we should make it mandatory, but I think it's an opportunity that, in general, work groups shouldn't pass on if the scheduling allows it.
Okay, and just as you know, chair of this group, I will say that the face-to-face we had in, where was it? Was it Sydney? We went over the survey results. I thought for me, and I think Marika also, I thought it was really valuable because I think it was, first of all, it was hard at the time to get people to come to the calls, and so it got a lot more people involved. And I think in going over the results in person, it really made people think. I could see when people were agreeing or kind of fidgeting that they didn't agree with something, and then I could, you know, call on them, and they would, you know, get it out of them, what was bothering them. I found it really helpful for that purpose. But I think you're right, Alan, in saying, A, it's hard to know what the working group is going to be on at that particular time because you do have to schedule it so far in advance. And I also agree that it is a great recruiting tool for the work group. But so I hear everything you're saying. James, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, just one more quick thing. I mean, I'm looking at the post-expiration working group that I'm chairing right now, and if we had had the wisdom a few weeks ago to stick up our hand and say we really need a face-to-face meeting in addition to the workshop, I would have. It's probably too late now. But if we had had this conversation a few months ago, I might have done that differently. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeff, this is James. I admit that my caution is purely a bit self-serving in that I am involved in a lot of working groups, and it's you know, the time that we're on site for an ICANN meeting is very, very scarce, and just trying to make the most of it. And I think that, you know, Alan and I are essentially saying the same thing, is that we want it to be available as an option, but we certainly just didn't want to see it as a mandatory step in the process.
Okay.
So we can make a recommendation and go from there. And I think that, you know, there is value to having face-to-face meetings, as I mentioned, just as a workshop, getting public feedback. We, I think, received a lot of feedback, you know, for some of the other groups that were, that what I want to call the normal weekly team was not discussing and probably should have been. So that kind of took our conversation in some new directions, as well as bringing in some new recruits. But, you know, it is expensive to get out to these meetings and to be there and to be out of the office, and I just want to make sure we're making the most use of that time then.
So I think does anyone want to add anything about meetings at a ICANN, a face-to-face at an ICANN meeting? I want to finish up that and then go on to a related one, which I know was brought up months ago by Marilyn, who's not on the call. But one of the things that Marilyn was saying is that there should be face-to-face meetings of working groups outside of the normal ICANN meeting. And if not a, quote, face-to-face, a related thing is maybe a half-day conference call or something where people could put aside everything else for a good half-day to work on some items. And if that were the case, then how would that be accomplished? So anyone want to touch those about a face-to-face meeting outside of an ICANN meeting? James was quick to raise his hand.
Yeah, I would just say that that both of those, the face-to-face or the half-day conference call, would be a couple of items where I would strongly suggest that we have some compelling reason for asking for those meetings.
And what would be an example of a compelling reason?
Well, if it were, for example, like, you know, you're probably more experienced or have some better visibility with the IRT, where you had a very, very short time frame where you're trying to accomplish something very specific in between ICANN meetings. So, you know, something that was very time-sensitive and a narrow or specific objective that required a broad spectrum of expertise.
And you think that's even the case, before I get to Alan, you think that's even the case for just a longer workshop over the phone or, you know, teleconferencing, maybe even video conferencing or WebEx?
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say yes, just because, you know, everyone's time, I think, is very, very valuable, and we want to make sure that if we're asking that of volunteers, and I think in previous sessions we've discussed volunteer, you know, hitting some sort of an upper limit of volunteer capacity or capabilities, and I think that we just need to be very mindful of what we're asking folks to do and make sure that it's for, you know, it's for a compelling reason.
Okay. Alan?
Off-site meetings can be exceedingly productive, but the cost is so enormous that it's hard to bite the bullet and say you want it. The cost not only in dollars or whatever is because you're going to have to, in any group, you're likely to have to fly some people really far and take a significant amount of time out of their lives for even for a one-day meeting. So the cost in both financial and time is so large that it's hard to imagine many scenarios where that's warranted. I mean, my first non-ICANN, or after I was appointed to the GNSO as liaison, a few months later, I did one of the off-site meetings for the GTLDs. And that was an exceedingly productive day, but it was an expensive venture, you know, both in terms of time and money. And I can't see many work groups that would warrant that, even if they are going to be productive in their own right. So
okay,
I strongly support it if we can justify it. In terms of six-hour conference calls, that's an awful grueling thing. I'm not sure how productive they get after they've been going for a few hours. It's not the same as when you can walk, you know, go out in the hall and eat an apple and have a drink of coffee and that kind of stuff in a real meeting. Conference calls that go on for several hours are killers.
Yeah, I agree. I think, though, it depends on, you know, if there are issues. You know, I can say that this work team has been, you know, we've gotten to some discussions that have been very productive during work teams, and then it's time for the call to end. And then we go 2 weeks without, you know, discussing it. I think there's continuity lost. I think.
Oh, yes.
There's, you know, and we haven't had the best participation on the email list. I think the best participation in this has been on phone calls. So, you know, maybe, you know, once a quarter or something as far as a longer conference call, possibly even a WebEx or something, or even a video conference call might actually, you know, might not be a bad idea.
It's clear a technology-based organization like ours should be trying some of these things at least occasionally and seeing if they help.
Yeah, I agree. Margie?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the effectiveness of face-to-face meetings. I was also staffing the IRT calls with that Jeff attended as well, and I thought we did a fantastic job of getting people together and really exploring the issues, you know, very deeply, and were able to work through some of the disagreements on a face-to-face way that you couldn't do over the phone. And one of the suggestions that I would have or propose is, you know, there's oftentimes meetings that a lot of the members of groups attend outside of ICANN meetings that might be appropriate places to perhaps convene a work team meeting if possible. I'm thinking of things like, you know, there's domainer conferences, there's INTA, sometimes ICANN has these global outreach or specific meetings that a lot of people attend. And that might be an area where it would be less expensive, but yet we might be able to get enough of the group together to, you know, and also have phone conferences for, you know, call-ins for people who can't participate to get more work done.
How would you get a face-to-face? Who would pay for that? Would ICANN pay for that?
You know, I think it's possible. I mean, it's certainly something that when you're – and maybe you go to the issue of whether there's a compelling need for it. Like, for example, you know, imminent restructuring, we need to get, you know, the new operating rules and procedures done or something. You know, something that's time-sensitive, you know, it's certainly something I think that could be explored.
So what other, well, I guess working groups will talk about that, but, you know, I think we may have kind of exhausted this topic. Does anybody want to add anything else on this? And we'll just jot these down as notes.
Just one comment on what Margie said. I agree with everything she said. How practical it is to really do it, I'm not sure. At Large has talked to ICANN a little bit on could we not have an opportunity to have at large meetings in parallel with the registrar registry meetings that are held. Since there's already staff, there's already organization going into it, and in many cases people are local to the meetings anyway, so the cost is not large. And one of the answers that comes back is, well, there's a big difference between arranging one room and five rooms and coordinating several different groups. And the answer basically was, this is going to cost a pile of money even if we're already holding something in that city. So I agree with the benefits. It may not be quite as simple as Margie was implying. But if we could pull it off, I think that would be a good thing.
Okay. If we jump ahead to, I'm sorry, Marika's got a, is that a new
hand? Okay. Yeah. No, I just wanted to point out that, of course, all this is a new document. So any of the questions in here are some that, you know, staff has put in there. So if there's anything else this group thinks that should fall under these categories, they should speak up or, you know, review the document after this call and provide some input so that we make sure that we cover any item that falls under these topics.
Yes, thank you, Marika. That's absolutely right. These are just ones that either staff added or ones that came up at some earlier meetings. The next one, communication with the Office of General Counsel. We've had discussions on this in stage, I want to say stage one, or it could have been two. I'm trying to put these two together. But we had discussions when it came down to whether something was in scope or out of scope. So we had discussions about that. This is really, you know, if the work team is coming up with a solution or working groups coming up with a solution or, you know, let me go back a step. We talked about earlier that it's hard for the general counsel to give an opinion because they don't know where the working group is going. And they don't want to presuppose some sort of outcome and then, you know, give their opinion on that. Here we're talking about, well, what if the working group is heading towards a certain outcome and it's pretty clear which way the working group is going. Maybe all the details haven't been finalized, but it's certainly clear the direction. Should there be some process in place to have that communication with the general counsel?
Doesn't there have to be? I mean, the alternative is, no, we're not going to tell you until you finish all your work that it's not valid.
And I think that latter may be closer to what the general counsel's office has previously expressed.
Okay.
But
touché.
You know, it sounds like it makes logical sense, but maybe it's something that should be formalized. Or does it have to go to the council first and then go to the
council spelled which way?
the bicameral GNSO council.
Oh.
before going to the
general counsel. I would hope not.
Any thoughts on that? Margie's got a thought. James? Okay, Margie?
I think it's important to try to consider getting advice from the legal department, the Office of General Counsel, at this stage. Because in the few dealings that I've, you know, on the working groups that I have worked on, sometimes it's what Jeff said is exactly right, that it's too premature in the early stages, and they really don't have a feel for where the council's headed or what's the likely policy outcome. And so this seems to me to be the right stage to try to build in some sort of procedure or check so that the group has an idea as to what the limitations are, whether they decide that they want to have a consensus policy that's binding on a contracted party, what the rules are. I mean, there's a lot of things that would be useful for the working group to know, you know, before they actually finalize their policy recommendation and send it to the council. So my recommendation would be to try to build in some sort of procedure at this stage.
Okay, and before I get to what those procedures should be, I'll go to James.
Yeah, I think I want to echo a lot of what Margie was just saying. I think that there's probably less of a danger of asking counsel to make to give us an opinion that was, you know, completely outside of you know, any sort of context when it, from my understanding of this question, it's only going to be issues of scope. Is that primarily what we're concerned with, is issues of scope? So it seems like that would be sufficiently narrow to get some guidance from general counsel on that. But I do think that there should be some sort of a checkpoint person, whether that's staff or whether that's the GNSO counsel or whether that's the council liaison taking that. I don't think necessarily that the working group itself should be able to necessarily just bring those issues, because I think that, you know, if it just becomes an extension of the myriad of scope discussions that we have on these working groups, I think that, you know, ICANN will quickly find itself needing a much larger legal department.
Well, so let me, you asked a good question when you started it. Is it just about scope? And I know that the question on here refers to scope, but I think, you know, would it not be also be helpful maybe if you need a contractual interpretation or something not about whether something's in scope, but let's say, for example, that the working group is talking about requiring a registry or registrar to do something. The question may be, is this something that contractually you could require? Is this something, maybe that is a scope question. Maybe it's a feasibility question. Let me go to Alan. He's got his hand raised.
You've just covered most of what I was going to say. I think it's not just scope of what you're allowed to talk about, but possible outcomes, options on how to address, on how to best structure an outcome. I think there's a number of things related to the contracts that these are affecting, and yes, I believe it should be wider than just scope. In terms of having to go to the GNSO Council first or a process like that, you're now talking about adding potentially a month or two to a process. You know, if you're only having meetings every 2 weeks, if you're out of sync with the three with the GNSO meetings that are only held typically every 3 weeks, you could end up adding a few months, you know, 2 months to this process when you really wanted an answer now to go on with your work. So I'd be careful about the roadblocks you put in the path of trying to get an answer to a question, especially if it happens to be a very focused question.
So before,
and this is James, I wanted there to be somebody that's kind of a gatekeeper of that process, Alan, whether it's the GNSO Council or the Council Liaison or the policy advisor attached to the, or assigned to the working group, or some, you know, I just wanted there to be some entity that was kind of collecting and running interference to make sure that channel isn't overly used.
And I think James, you actually brought up, you know, something I was thinking about too. Is it possible that the person that should channel it is the ICANN staff member of that? Well, not just your member, but ICANN staff personnel that's assigned to that work team. You know, I think that person could hopefully, and maybe Marika and Margie would disagree, but hopefully that person would have better access to the general counsel or general counsel's office, I should say, than the chair of the work team, any work team members, or even the council. So I see Margie and Marika. So Margie, you want to tackle that?
Yeah. Sure, and I think that's where I was headed, that it's probably best to have the staff person, ICANN staff, because they have all the background and information. You know, general counsel's office just doesn't track the email list and know where the working group is, and there'll be a lot of back and forth to even understand the question and the possible policy parameters. So I think what we've done, we've sort of done that informally, and maybe Marika can address how it happens, you know, generally. That would be my recommendation, to have it be, you know, probably come go through the staffer.
Okay, Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to initiate what Adeline Marge said, I think that hasn't even been the practice. Normally, if a group had a specific question, I would take it back to general counsel and you know, provide the feedback to the working group. But one thing I wanted to add as well is something that we've seen in some of the recent working groups is the, you know, the request for the participation of someone from the compliance team, especially with view of seeing that certain solutions are actually going to help the compliance teams do their job better or make sure that any recommendations are going to be enforceable. That may be something that hasn't come up here in any of the issues, but talking about, you know, how to involve the general counsel, that's another avenue that's currently being used to make sure that outcomes, you know, we get the most out of the outcomes that a group puts forward.
Okay, so what then would be the other, so what recommendations, if we were going to make one, would it be, obviously, as you know, not everything should go to the general counsel. What would the process be? How would they determine what is an issue for the general counsel? What kind of time frame should the general counsel be given to respond? And when I say general counsel, I mean the office, not necessarily the general counsel. Ricky, your hands up. Is that on this or is that old?
Sorry, so just take it down.
Oh, that's okay. You wanted to answer. Maybe that's just one to think about, and we'll just kind of put the notes down of this conversation, and maybe we can, you know, maybe enough. Just what we want is that there should be more open communication between the working groups and the Office of the General Counsel, where guidance is needed to interpret issues of scope or contract or some sort of legal issue.
Yeah, it's Alan. I would support what Marika said. I think we want it wider than just Office of General Counsel. There are a number of groups within ICANN that need to be consulted at times. Compliance is one. General Counsel is another. There are probably a few others, and I don't see any reason not to generalize it.
That's a fair point. That's right.
Now, in terms of how quickly they respond, overnight, of course.
Of course. Now Marika's got her hand up again.
Yes, I did put my hand up again. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the next phase when we talk about implementation, I think that's where one of the questions where that comes back again as well. Like, should this group, should the working group be tasked as well to provide, implementation guidance? And there, of course, the question comes in. You know, you would need to work very closely probably with people in the services, ICANN services team, to talk at, how can you actually implement and what things are workable and feasible. So, absolutely agree with Alan that, sometimes those discussions, it's helpful if they already go wider, so you come out with something that's very clear and implementable and enforceable.
I like the idea of just throwing it over the wall and blaming them if they don't do it right.
Yeah.
So why don't we change issues to be addressed instead of communication with the Office of General Counsel? It's communication with different ICANN services or something like that. I don't know if it's how ICANN's broken down. But you brought up the services.
Department, probably.
Yeah, okay. Because I've heard services department, I've heard the compliance department, heard the Office of the General Counsel. Now maybe the work group wants to demand a meeting with the CEO. I'm kidding. Okay, so on the next item is, and this one's very abstract, and I've tried to think about this, and every time I do it, kind of just, maybe it's just me, but it's linking policy development with the ICANN strategic planning and budgeting. The part A is the more abstract one, which is how to link policy development with ICANN strategic planning and budgeting. And B is if costs such as experts or research are expected to be significant, should the policy work be deferred until the resources have been budgeted? And I would say it's abstract and it's very difficult for a work group because we're all volunteers. We don't have the insight into the ICANN budget in order to determine what resources have been put aside or when additional resources will be needed. We would know things like, hey, it'd be great to have antitrust legal opinion on this, or it'd be great to have an economic study on this. But I'm not sure how the working group considers this. So, Alan?
I think we're coming to head with a subject that comes up periodically in ICANN, where the statement is made that the budget and the operational plan are driven off the strategic plan, and that is what we're supposed to be working on. And I think that's true for the big things, whether it's IDN or new GTLDs. Now, I'm told the new GTLD PDP was driven by an item in the strategic plan going back N years. But much of what the GNSO works on is demand-driven, is problem-driven. The world changes quickly, and we feel that something has to be done. And these items usually are not in the strategic plan. They maybe orthogonal to something that's in the strategic plan. And I think any time we're going to have an issue in the PDP process that we're working on, which mentions strategic plan and budget, it has to be in with an if applicable. We work on just too many things which are not in the plan, would never be in the plan, or would be in the plan so many years out that it would be irrelevant. And yet we can't avoid to work on some of these.
Right, or they're in the plan, they're just a subset, a very small subset of something that could fit into something. You know, if the strategic plan says we're going to create a security group and the security group is going to focus on these 10 things, you know, if we come up with, it could be something that's not...
If you're lucky, you'll find a fit.
Right. So, Marika, and then, Marika?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to note, because I think this is something that came up in the BCG report, and you know, I would like to see and look back if they provided some more details of what they actually meant with it. Because I struggle indeed with the same thing of, you know, how can you link that? Well, so many policy issues are, you know, problem-driven, and it's because of something that's happening now. So I'll take the task to look back at that report and see if there's something more in there that might help structure this question.
Okay. If we look at do we want to also hold off on B as well as the cost and the budgeting? I mean, actually, that's a separate issue. So when the work group wants to do a study or wants to do something that's going to cost money, how does that work? I mean, right now, so what happened, I think the only real example I could think of right now is the Who Is studies, right? That was something that GNSO wanted to do, and then they had to get feasibility studies and, I guess, money for a budget for that.
Well, post-expiration is now doing a survey, which is going to cost ICANN money. No one's talked about it. It's not a lot of money, but it's time.
And does ICANN just say, okay, we'll do it? I mean, how does that work?
No, well... Rika hasn't raised the issue.
The question was asked, is staff able to do it? And we said, well, you know, we're happy if it's, as long as we're not surveying all the registrars, we're happy to try to get as much information as possible. So I think sometimes it depends a bit as well on, you know, what is being asked and, how many resources are available.
Okay. Well, has there been anything, so the Who Is studies, those were presumably pretty expensive. James, you have a comment?
I'm wondering if we can take a different tack with this category, and I just wanted to put this out on the table. It's the possibility that there be some sort of an assessment of the in an issues report of how a given topic would be either, aligned or neutral or counter to strategic planning, and just having some sort of an assessment in the issues report and leaving it as simple as that. And then as far as the budgeting, I don't know if, I think personally, just as if the GNSO, has activities that they want to, that they feel are going to cause them to go over and above, then perhaps they could, ask for and incorporate when the budget comes around for a comment period, and it's I think a fairly collaborative process, is making sure that they get some sort of support built into that, and then maybe that budgeting process helps to drive the prioritization and docket issue that we were talking about in a previous session.
Has the GNSO ever really had to check on budget? I mean, it's never really been an issue the GNSO has. Council has ever really, that I can recall, talked about. It's just the GNSO Council decides they want to do something and they do it, or they ask, and I don't think they really consider the budget that's, ICANN's finance department, they put aside money for the GNSO and supporting policy activity, but I don't think the GNSO has actually given insight into how much money is spent and how much money GNSO's not really allocated any money.
Well, it's not only that, we don't even get any feedback as to what something costs. to sort of appreciate it even after the fact. I mean, occasionally there are statements that this would be too expensive, but I don't think it ever gets more specific than that. Even that doesn't happen very often. Certainly on the who is, that subject came up a number of times, that if we were to do all the studies, it would cost a huge amount of money.
Well, and am I wrong? This is James. Am I wrong to ask why that wouldn't be? I mean, I think that the council, certainly they're not drawing from an infinite pool of resources, and they understand that. So why not plan for that and then, give some feedback on performance of, what activities are impacting those resources and what remains, and then that might help, might help the planning process.
Completely rational statement. I'm not sure it could happen.
I have to be careful with those.
having sat on a group which has been asking that for the last 3 years with no results yet, I'm not sure.
So, Marika, is this something maybe you could have a discussion with the finance team, Kevin Wilson's team, is to figure out exactly how something like this would work, or why it is the case that even though there's money allocated for the GNSL policy process, there's really no insight given to the council or anyone else for that matter as to how you're operating against it and whether there are limits or parameters. I mean, it's just kind of like, is there a better way that the GNSO could know what it's got left or whether something it would do would fit within the budgeting, with the budget?
Okay, I can check on that.
Jeff, this may be one of the things we don't want to do, It's sort of nice not knowing how much it costs and not having to think about it. There's a responsibility that comes along with knowing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm of the opinion that if you want to increase your expenditures, don't budget for them, because then they start to look like this magical pot of gold that is bottomless.
So the issues were raised. I think we should address them, and maybe our recommendation is: look, you know what? We think it's working. It's working okay for now. It's only been, it's only really come up once or twice where someone's come back and said, we can't do what you want to do because it's just too much. I think travel funding might be another, it's not really a policy issue, never mind.
But it's a good example. If you look at, we're allocated number of bodies, not dollars. It makes the accounting simpler in dealing with us, but it hides, it obfuscates some of the real budget issues. So,
right, and then I noticed the I think it's right. So maybe just an understanding, and maybe just to see, we may or may not recommend something to do with that. But I think we should at least have a discussion, or Marika should have a discussion and give us some feedback.
Yeah, the part about being in line with or orthogonal to the strategic and operational plan, though, I think is something we should note, because part of the reality is that we are dealing with demand-driven, situation-driven issues very often, which were not predicted 3 years ago when the plan was written or 9 months ago when the budget was approved.
Okay. Should we go on to probably do another 10, 15 more minutes? we want to go on to the fourth one, which is timing. Let me see which – there's like a timing element in each of these stages. So this one is so the current revised, which are now the current bylaws, state that it's – well, they state that – a constituency. All right. Well, this has task forces in it, in which the timing for soliciting a constituency statement, for example, is dependent on whether there's a task force or a work group in the current bylaws. So it might actually be more difficult to look at what's currently going on than to try to come up with.
I don't think the current bylaw the now current bylaw doesn't have task forces, does it?
Well, actually it does, because it's still the now current bylaws are still the old ones. They just modified the voting thresholds. Correct, Mark?
You're right. You're right.
So I think we've all agreed to abolish the notion of the Council of the Whole and the task forces. So I think the next incarnation will only have working groups. So the question is, and instead of constituency, we're now, well, I mean, we're talking about both constituency and stakeholder groups. Because this is definitely an issue that we're supposed to address as opposed to the work teams, Not that I'm trying to push it off.
Is that wishful thinking I hear in that question?
The working team is not looking at all on the timing issues, as far as I know.
Okay. So let me actually address, and I think we may have talked about this on another call, but I'm not sure we came to any resolution. Do we want to actually, I'm going to say this and I'm going to regret it because maybe we did talk about it more than I think. Once a working group is formed and the charter is agreed and now you're constituting the working group, is it something we should require before the working group starts to work is to having these constituency statements or stakeholder group statements? Is that the way we still want to operate going forward? Or is it putting the cart before the horse, in essence, by asking people too broad of a question to give too much input?
Well, our practice right now is somewhere in between the two things you said. That is, we don't stop the working group practice while we're asking, but we ask relatively early in the process.
And has it slowed anything down? Has it... Or is it by the time you get, because I know, it, and Marika's got a point, but by the time you actually get a stakeholder group or constituency statement, it's so long down the pike. I mean, it could be as short as 30 days, but it could be a lot longer to get a constituency statement. By that time, has the work group moved beyond that? So Marika's got a...
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is Marika. I just wanted to need to know what Anand said, that, you know, we definitely don't have constituency statements before working group starts. Normally, it is a parallel process. The working group works on normally a template that they send to the constituencies in which they ask, you know, specific questions that they would like input on, and often that's just a charter question. And at the same time, the working group then starts debating those issues in parallel. And in one way, it works out quite well because, you know, it does give the working group in one way the freedom to, you know, discuss in an empty, open environment without any ideas on the table yet. And by the time that they have, you know, gone into depth on these issues and a better understanding, that's often when the constituency statements come in, where, you know, it's often experts talking around these issues and providing some more detailed ideas and suggestions. So then the working group can take it from there. So at least from the working groups I've been involved with so far, that process seems to work quite okay. Although we've seen now that constituencies and stakeholder groups are a bit overwhelmed as well with all the work going on, and there's delay in time that they can deliver those statements. But at the same time, many working groups, you know, are meeting on biweekly basis, so they sometimes take longer as well to get to the stage where they otherwise would have been.
Well, so that's kind of my question is, could it be up, instead of having it as a requirement up at the beginning, even if it runs in parallel, could it be something at the working group, each working group has the discretion? I mean, at some point it's got to seek the constituency stakeholder group opinion, along with the public opinion, mind you. Could it be up to the working group? Could it be left up to the working group to determine when that is and how it's structured? Because oftentimes, I mean, and maybe this is more early on, I've noticed that when the constituencies are asked to put out a statement, it's so broad, and then oftentimes what happens is the constituency ends up coming up with a completely separate statement later on once solutions are being discussed. Or maybe that's appropriate. I don't know. Alan?
Yeah, I think the situation has changed over time. To some extent, the constituencies are going to have strong opinions are also likely to have people on the working group. So it's not as if there's complete isolation, but the people who are on the working group in general are on their own behalf, and you cannot presume that they are speaking on behalf of the constituency. So I think I feel that you really do have to, early in the process, ask the constituency if they want to make a formal statement regarding the PDP, which is now starting. They're not obliged to, but I don't think you want to not avail yourselves of those summary opinions of the constituency at the beginning if they have something to say to you.
Yeah, I think that does make sense. Marika, do you?
I agree with Anand, because I think you do run the risk that if you don't get the state constituency input, you might run the risk that at the end of the day, constituency might turn back and saying, "Oh, but we don't like that outcome at all," and you know, on a council level, it will be voted down. While of course, I think the idea is that the council is going to take a more managerial role. So I think it's very important to have that input. And even though, you know, like the working group has to work through these issues, and indeed constituencies might change their minds, you know, once they have seen, you know, have received feedback from some of their members that are participating in the working group, and new items have come to light. But I think it's very useful to have that information early on, so the working group can as well position themselves. And even though, you know, most of them are participating as individuals, they will already see where their constituency sits, and I presume most of them will also be involved in developing those constituency statements. So that at the end of the day, we do come up with something that, you know, is supported, or at least we have received input on from all the different parties involved.
Okay, I mean, James, you have a comment on that too?
Yeah, just a comment real quickly on what Marika was saying, that, you know, it's constituencies or stakeholder groups or whatever should be sending, you know, if they have a stake in the outcome of a policy development process, they should be participating in its development. I'm just not very sympathetic to the I didn't see this coming, you know, when it reaches the council level, because there's several opportunities to get involved. That's all.
So let me take a poll from the group, because it sounds like at least the people that are talking support still having the constituency statement from the outset. So before we get to timing, could everybody put a check mark or an X if they agree or disagree? By the way, the X is if you disagree.
Please restate the question.
Does everyone agree or disagree with the notion of continuing the practice of requiring a constituency or allowing for a constituency to submit a statement at the outset of a PDP?
You're saying requiring that the working group solicit them.
I'm saying requiring that the working group give the option, yes.
Yes, okay.
Right, yes, requiring that they... Requiring that they solicit, not requiring that a constituency responds.
All right.
How do you make a check mark?
You go to the where it's on Adobe attendee list, and bottom left-hand corner, there is a person whose hand is raised, and next to it an arrow. And
or,
then,
or the pull down just above all the check marks.
That too. I'm going to applaud. Give some people are paying attention. Okay, it seems like there's a fair agreement on that concept. So let me ask then, timing. Right now it says within 10 days. within 10 days they have to ask for it, and then it's within 35 days after the initiation. Realistic, unrealistic thoughts? Wolf has a comment. Or maybe not.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to check it, but it was wrong.
Sorry.
That's fine. Marika, you have a comment on that?
Yeah, no, just to note on the two recent constituency statements that we've requested, we actually asked to those in the working group, like, what is reasonable, and most of them indicated that 30 days would be a reasonable time frame to come back with an answer on the issues put before them. And sometimes they do need an extension, because, you know, recently we've seen that 30 days even wasn't enough, even though people said it would be enough, and they've asked for 2 weeks more. So maybe it could be 30 days, you know, of course, with the possibility for an extension if the group requests or constituencies request on.
Well, since it's optional, could we not just say keep it at the 35 that's in there, or even 45? It is optional as to whether a constituency wants to submit a statement. I think since timelines are actually moving out and there's not the rigid time frame, I'm not sure how far along the working group will be. But, Alan, you might have a comment on that.
The current one says 35 days. I'm happy to live with it and either have implicit or we can make explicit that the working group has the prerogative to extend that if necessary. The time delay, the time frame of doing it within 10 days is totally ludicrous.
I think the within 10 days was to actually request that the request needs to go out.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You think that that requiring it to go out within 10 days after the group is created?
With the process of doodling and getting groups together, it typically takes at least 3 weeks for the group to meet the first time.
I gotcha, okay.
And then they probably won't take any real decisions at the first meeting because it's going to be organizational. And the next meeting they're going to be is 2 weeks out. We're now talking 5 weeks from the time the PDP was called, and the call hasn't gone out yet.
Well, you could always say at the first organizational meeting of the work team, like within 10 days of that.
I don't think you can, because you need to discuss what you're going to ask. Are you just going to ask the constituency to comment on the words in the charter, or do you want to do more in-depth questioning based on where you see this whole process going? At least, certainly, if I look at the PDP that I've just started working on, that's the case. It wasn't cut and dry. We ended up taking a simple approach at the end, but it wasn't obvious that's the way we were going when we started.
So if you don't put it on time, which is what it sounds like you're having an issue with, you do need it early enough on in the process where the work group is not too far along.
Yes.
So what can you attach it to if it's not time?
You could probably attach it to time and say within 60 days. That sounds like a long time. You may say within, you know, the first three meetings of the working group, or the first, you know, I don't know. It's all going to translate to longer times than we're going to feel comfortable about.
Or do you just say that this should be one of the first items that the work group has to deal with?
I could live with that. We have staff people to goad us on.
Marika, what do you think of that?
I agree with that approach. I just want to note as well, and that's something I probably need to feedback as well to the working group work team, although I think they're waiting as well for the PDP work team to finalize its work so they can put in as well a specific example on how a working group should run their things on a PDP. I think it's a very valid point because for now we do have a section in there like, what should be covered in the first meeting? And I think it makes sense to put, this item on there that at least the group is aware that they should do that in, one of their first meetings to work on that. And again, I think that's something that's happening in practice because, staff does alert the group to the fact that they're, supposed to request constituency input and, we always suggest maybe a template might facilitate that. And it also gives the option of asking more specific questions that, the group might come up with in the first couple of meetings. But again, I think, that's something maybe we want to put in the other recommendations or in a guidebook that, we might develop for the PDP. I don't think a working group should be prevented from going back to constituencies with specific questions at a later stage. And I think, that's probably already happening in practice as well now, where we're, for example, looking at doing a specific registrar survey where we're turning to the registrar community for specific input or information on certain items. So I think that's something to keep in mind as well.
I think that's right. And I think, so before we get on to number five, and this kind of is a segue sort of to number five, right now it says in the bylaws constituencies. So the first more obvious one is, do we change it to constituencies and stakeholder groups, or do we also add supporting organizations? Is it a more generalized, why are we just getting opinions from constituencies or stakeholder groups? Is that still appropriate? Should we get opinions from other supporting organizations, from advisory committees, or even from the public as a whole? Why should this be opened up to everyone to file a comment at the outset?
Jeff, just on that point, if you're talking with the community as a whole, there is as well this requirement to have a public comment period at the beginning. I think we covered that in the previous phase. At the beginning of the initiation of a PDP, but now in practice that often happens at the start of the working group. So for the public as a whole, there is, for the moment, there is this already this place.
Was that more on whether to initiate the PDP or not, as opposed to?
Yes, but in practice it's being used as a way to get input as well on those, normally on the charter questions. I mean, the original intent was just to announce the initiation of a PDP, but most working groups use it as a way to get public input early on the charter questions they're going to be looking at.
Okay, Alan, and then I kind of have to get going. Maybe Marika, can you just finish out this subject and then...
My comment is really quick.
Okay, Alan.
Yeah. I think right now, de facto, council and working groups have been asking advisory committees and other supporting organizations if they thought there was some reasonable overlap. And I think we want words in there which enlarge the request for, quote, constituency statements to the larger group as applicable or something like that. You know, advisory committees and supporting organizations as applicable, and leave it at that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Okay, so I think we made some good progress today. I'm more avowed now because we have several people that like to speak and some that don't, which is fine, but maybe I'm going to seek more polls during the calls to get other people at least to just weigh in whether they agree or disagree. I think that might be helpful. With that, again, please, everybody, respond respond to the survey by Monday, which is the date that it closes, so that we really can have a good discussion on the survey for the next call. And the next call will be at our normal scheduled time next Thursday. So we're going weekly at this point till the SOL meeting for the next 3 weeks. The call after that will also be on a Thursday, so 2 weeks from today. But we need to find a new time since the council is meeting at our normally regular scheduled time, so a doodle poll will go out. The call after that will be at our normal scheduled time.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Talk to you after the game, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley.